You're listening to New Hampshire Now.
Welcome back here on New Hampshire Now. Dine 1450 and ConcordNewsRadio.com. I am Chris Ryan. I appreciate you joining us for the program. This hour, but brought to you by Riverbend Community Mental Health. And this segment of the show, presented by Paradigm Plumbing, Heating, Air Conditioning, as we are on Capitol Hill. Honored to be joined in his office by United States Senator Mike Lee from the great state of Utah. Senator Lee, how are you?
Doing great. Thank you very much, Chris.
Appreciate joining us for the show. And obviously, there's a lot of things going on here in D.C. And you know, the pragmatic side of me wonders what is going to come of a lot of the discussions in regards to health care and tax reform. And you know, for a state like New Hampshire, we've heard a lot of the negative sides of Graham Cassidy from Senators Shaheen and Hassan, even Governor Sununu saying he doesn't like the bill based upon the fact that there could be a potential shortfall of $1 billion between 2020 and 2026 in regard to Medicare, Medicaid. So what do you see as the strongest argument and attributes for Graham Cassidy? And is there the potential for changes to be made in order to affect the block grant so that it's more proportional to New Hampshire to allow for that Medicaid to be funded still?
The benefits of Graham Cassidy involve more local control, involve hopefully less federal regulation. Now, we're still working our way through the bill, and the bill is still in something of a state of flux. What I'm looking for are indications that it will reduce the federal regulations that are currently burdening our healthcare system. This is has everything to do with why the cost of healthcare has grown astronomically in recent years. Graham Cassidy, to the extent that it can deliver real relief to hardworking Americans, especially to middle-class families, that's going to be the sweet spot. That's what we're looking for.
And one of the other aspects, obviously, is the pre-existing conditions, and as I mentioned, the Medicaid as well. And for me, as a fiscal conservative, I want to reduce the amount of individuals on Medicaid as much as possible. I want to reduce the subsidization of healthcare as much as possible. But when you have, as we've seen with other programs across the course of history, when you have things that are in place, unless there is some sort of a real plan to replace those or to wean people off it until there is an entity that allows for those individuals to gain affordable health care or health insurance, that creates an environment now where there's, you know, the panic of what's going to happen to an individual with pre-existing conditions, what's going to happen to a person who's on Medicaid. So do you think the conservatives have done a good enough job in, you know, providing an offset to taking away or easing out various aspects of the Affordable Care Act?
Well, yes. In fact, the bigger knock on Graham Cassidy from the conservative side is that it doesn't do enough to walk away from Obamacare. Look, Obamacare was really bad for American health care. It was supposed to improve access to care. It was supposed to improve the affordability of care, as the name implies, and yet it did quite the opposite. So I think that's the real rub against it, is that it doesn't do enough to move in the opposite direction. Also, we have to remember, for those critics out there, for those who were skeptical of any effort to repeal or even rescind any part of Obamacare, we have to remember that the federal government's not the only show in town. In fact, it was always supposed to be the states that would be primarily responsible for regulating most aspects of our lives, for most legislation. And except in those cases where the Constitution makes something federal, the states are supposed to have primacy. The distribution of health care varies dramatically from one state to another, depending on local preferences, geography, patterns in how the populations are distributed. What works well in New Hampshire might be very different from what works well in Utah or Nevada or California or Alaska. And so each state needs to have more control. We should be walking away from focusing on Washington, D.C. in every instance.
Right, but again, going back to the Medicaid portion of things and how that, you know, affects New Hampshire, if it's a true block grant, absolutely. I think you're 100% right. I agree. Local control, whether it's at the, you know, the city, the town, school boards, and state level is more important. But how do you change, you know, the disproportionality and have it as a true block grant? Do you think that is what's going to be needed in order to get passage? Because obviously Sununu would be on board. He liked the bill, but he sees, you know, the fact that there's going to be a disproportional amount of Medicaid money going to states like Missouri, and New Hampshire ends up with a huge decision to make in regards to their budget.
Okay, so here again, I'll start with the point that states are free to subsidize health care in addition to whatever they get for the federal, from the federal government. And there are a thousand different ways we could allocate a formula for a block grant. I'm open to any improvements on this bill that might be proposed. I'm not going to suggest for a minute that this thing is perfect or that it was carved on a stone tablet. But again, we have to focus back on the fact that this is neither a floor nor a cap necessarily. It certainly is not a ceiling on what states can spend on their own on health care. They're free to subsidize it to any additional degree they want. States ought to be able to have a single-payer, government-run, government-funded health care system if they want. I don't think that's a particularly good idea. I wouldn't want to live in a state where that were the mindset. But states do have that power, and the more the federal government can get away from it, the more the states will be empowered to do what their population wants.
That's U.S. Senator Mike Lee joining us here on Capitol Hill. Tax reform, this has been needed for such a long period of time. We talked about it on the program for years and years and years. We need to see a decrease in business taxes. I'd like to see something done with payroll taxes. And middle-class families, you know, as I've mentioned before, I think that the big message of the last election was that the middle in the country is frustrated. They're tired of individuals at the top and the bottom seeing all the benefits from government while they are left behind. So particularly in regards to the middle class, what do you want to see in regards to tax reform? What's being discussed in regards to tax reform to help the middle that has seen costs rise and their incomes remain stagnant?
One thing that I've maintained for years we need to get rid of is the marriage tax penalty. But there is another penalty affecting American families that is lesser known called the parent tax penalty. This is something Senator Rubio and I have been working on together for several years. And more recently, we've been working closely with Ivanka Trump. We have a plan that would mitigate the effects of the parent tax penalty. This is a sort of a quirk of the way the tax code interacts with our senior entitlement programs, Social Security and Medicare. It results in parents bearing a disproportionate burden. We want to alleviate that. I love the idea of any kind of middle class tax relief, and I also think we ought to take a close look at the corporate tax. Mm-hmm. The corporate tax is in fact borne by middle class Americans who pay higher prices on goods and services. Mm-hmm. They also pay for it with diminished wages, unemployment, and underemployment. And I would actually be supportive of getting rid of it altogether and making up for the difference with an adjustment on dividends and capital gains. I think that would make for a fairer, more transparent tax code, and one that didn't disproportionately and sort of non-transparently impact America's middle-class families.
Do you see the potential for, you know, bipartisan agreements, and you're even obviously Republicans control things if you're able to, you know, get the get everyone together and whipped into order. Do you see the potential for these types of changes occurring? Because again, I think it's something that you know, the middle class and folks that are struggling have been kind of begging for.
The possibility, yes. The likelihood, no. Not on tax reform. Look, there are a lot of issues on which there is a real opportunity, opportunity that sometimes goes untapped, sometimes doesn't, for bipartisan cooperation in Washington. There are other issues on which the parties are sort of irreconcilably at odds with each other. This is not the product of mere petulance on the part of individual members. It instead reflects a deep-seated, genuine disagreement among the American people about what the federal government ought to be, its size, its cost, how we ought to pay for it, and so forth. I'm not sure there's any easy way around that, but in this circumstance, we do have ways of getting something through, even if there aren't any Democrats who want to get on board with what we're proposing.
I think you make a great point about the expectation in regards to the federal government, because there is a belief by some that it should be as limited as possible, and there's a belief by some that it should be as big as possible. And the middle, everybody has their programs that they like, and they're for cutting things, as I'm sure you've noticed when you run for office. A lot of the people that come to you are the ones that want something, and particularly if you run for governor's office, you end up making a lot of promises because everybody wants more money. Where do you see, you know, the argument moving? Because healthcare is a great point where this is something that's most people the Affordable Care Act don't really like, but they've become used to it, and they like the certain aspects of it, or they don't want to see individuals with pre-existing conditions, you know, discriminated against, and so forth. So how do you win the argument in regards to the size and scope of government, particularly for an individual like yourself who has come to D.C. as, you know, a new generation of leadership yourself, and, you know, Senator Cotton, Senator Sasse, Senator Cruz, Rand Paul, to, you know, change the direction of Washington?
As I see it, Chris, that deal was reached 230 years ago this week. We've been celebrating Constitution Week this Constitution Day this week, and the Founding Fathers got together in the summer of 1787 in Philadelphia, and they hammered out a compromise. And what they came up with was a list of powers that were necessarily unavoidably federal in nature, that needed to be exercised at the national level. They included things like national defense, weights and measures, trademarks, copyrights and patents, regulating trade or commerce between the states with foreign nations. That list is more or less today what it was then. In other words, that language is still as applicable today as it was back then. And this is really neither Republican nor Democratic. It's neither liberal nor conservative. This is simply an American ideal. It is a constitutional mandate, in fact, that we reserve all other powers to the states and localities. Over the last 80 years, Congress has drifted from these principles. It's one of the reasons why I wrote my new book called Written Out of History, was to help restore the American people with stories from the founding era about how we got to this point, about why it made good sense, why it still makes good sense today, to recognize that there was an outer bound limit around federal power. But that's a limit that we've been ignoring for about 80 years, and it's got to stop.
You're absolutely right, and I think that's your book was really good, by the way, and that was really interesting because I'm very
interested.
Yeah, I did. I actually read some excerpts of it because I went into deep preparation for this interview, obviously. But that's always an interesting aspect of history. As we go off topic, is who are the people that were there but are forgotten? Who are the stories that are told and not told? And, you know, to me, as is the case with a president or with a senator or with any sort of movement, there are certain individuals who just kind of fall by the wayside. And way off topic, you know, I've a friend down in Memphis, his name's J.M. Van Eaton, and he was the Sun studio drummer. And I, for the life of me, I can't figure out why he is not more of a part of the history of music, because he laid the backbeat of rock and roll playing on Jerry Lewis's records. And that's what really spurred me to think about, you know, the individuals from history who are not remembered.
That's a great story. That could prompt another book, Written Out of Rock.
Right.
But yeah, there are all sorts of things that allow us to drift from who we are, from our story as a country. One of those things is just the passage of time. You know, the fact that we're 230 years away from the drafting of our Constitution itself allows people to forget certain things. But as I point out in my book, some of our forgotten founders, like Canasatego, the Iroquois Indian chief from the Onondaga tribe, who taught Benjamin Franklin about federalism, this principle that you've got a few powers that can be made national, and then all other things should be left to local governments. That was not something we inherited from the British. That was a distinctively American, arguably a Native American principle. But we've forgotten about Canasatego, in part because we've forgotten about federalism. It stands to reason if we can remember Canasatego and others who had an impact on the Constitution by involving this principle of federalism into it, I think we can recover and we can reclaim the benefits of it. And again, this can benefit Democrats and Republicans alike. It's just something we've got to do as a country.
In concluding, you were one of the leaders of the Never Trump movement through the course of the presidential campaign. And I'm curious as to, you know, as you see this playing out, and as you see, you know, Donald Trump as President of the United States, has he met the concerns that you had? Has he surpassed, you know, your expectations for the type of president he would be, particularly in regards to, as we've been discussing, you know, the Constitution and the powers of government and how they should be executed?
I had my doubts, and so far, this president has proven himself to be someone who wants to drain the swamp. I was encouraged on day one when he was sworn into office in his inaugural address. He said today represents much more than a shift from one administration to another, one president to another, one party to another. This will represent a shift of power from Washington, D.C. back to the American people, where that power belongs. I took courage in that and have been pleased with it. So far, this president has gotten rid of 16 regulations for every new one he's introduced. So far, this president has fought tirelessly to get us to repeal and replace Obamacare and for tax reform. And he's fighting for regulatory reform. That is the kind of leadership we need in Washington. I say keep it coming.
In regards to, you know, the temperament side of things, the stability side of things, the foreign policy side of things, obviously he is not, and as we know with New Hampshire, everybody has their first, you know, two or three favorite presidential candidates, and then you end up having the one that ends up winning. Are there concerns that still exist in regards to his temperament, his execution of the office?
With any president, there are always going to be concerns about how this decision is made or that decision is made or this or that aspect of the style of the president's delivery. And I don't know that that's all that helpful for us to micromanage at the outset, especially when we're only still a few months into his administration. What is, I think, more helpful, more productive at this point is to look forward to what he's going to do. I hope that he continues his efforts to restore power back to the American people where it belongs, his efforts to restore federalism, to restore separation of powers, to undo the massive federal regulatory state that's costing the American economy $2 trillion a year. Now, there again, that like the corporate tax, is not paid for by big corporate fat cats who we caricature in our minds as sort of a Mr. Peanut character with a double-breasted suit and a monocle. These costs are, in fact, borne by poor middle-class Americans who find everything they do more expensive and less affordable as a result of this federal behemoth. Meanwhile, six of our nation's 10 wealthiest counties are suburbs of Washington, D.C., an area that produces nothing, manufactures nothing. It's not a banking hub. It's not a mining hub. It's not a farming hub. The money is here only because the power is here, concentrated in the hands of a few elites. That's inexcusable.
Well, it was great to meet you, and perhaps we'll see you in New Hampshire at some point down the road. And thank you for taking some time.
Thank you, Chris.
We're back with more on New Hampshire Now from Washington, D.C. on Capitol Hill after this.
You're listening to New Hampshire Now.
Well, I hit home like a stone, and I fell heavy into your arms. These days of darkness, which we've known, will blow away. But I'll kneel down, wait for now. And I'll kneel down, know my ground. And I will wait for you. And I will wait for you.